The Doug Flutie Jr. Foundation for Autism is proud to be the presenting sponsor of the Boston Marathon's Adaptive Program for Runners, creating opportunities for runners with autism and other disabilities to participate in the legendary Boston Marathon.
Hi, my name is Mike Palmer, and I'm running as a member of the Adaptive Program for Runners in this year's Boston Marathon. Thanks to the Flutie Foundation, runners like me can achieve their dreams and finish the greatest race in the world.
The Flutie Foundation promotes inclusion for all to help everyone achieve their running dreams in Boston and beyond. Visit FlutieFoundation.org to get involved.
It's an offseason like no other for the Patriots. And the Sunday Football Show, Bob Soucy and Ted Johnson will keep you updated on all the latest moves on 98.5, The Sports Hub.
Touchdowns now in postseason history. The old Patriot teammates reunite in the Super Bowl for a score.
End zone.
Caught! Gronkowski again with the touchdown.
There's the fake. There's the pass.
And there's the catch for the touchdown. Antonio Brown.
Bittersweet sounds, perhaps, from Super Bowl 55. Tom Brady to Rob Gronkowski. Two of the touchdowns for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Of course, another expatriate, albeit briefly, Antonio Brown, caught another, Leonard Fournette, as well with a touchdown for the Buccaneers. And those are three guys that Tom Brady helped recruit to Tampa Bay on that Buccaneers
interesting.
Team.
Interesting. Very
delivering
interesting.
Delivering his seventh Super Bowl title. And we want to talk a little bit about last Sunday's game, but with a larger picture view, Ted, because you look at the impact as we rejoin you on the Sunday Football Show here on 98.5 The Sports Hub, Bob Soucy with Ted Johnson. You look at what the Bucs did against the Chiefs, both sides of the ball. They really varied what they usually do offensively and defensively.
Yeah, it was amazing, Bob, to kind of see the similarities in which both sides of the ball, offense and defense for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and even the coaching to some degree, like kind of mirrored what the Patriots like to do. I mean, you can't help but to think that Tom Brady not only went to Tampa Bay to be their quarterback, but he also brought philosophies and I think, ideologies that he learned from Bill Belichick and the Patriots with him to Tampa Bay. And for example, okay, you saw Tampa Bay very patient on offense, all right? It was very much a death by a thousand paper cuts kind of offense. Now, Tom knew because Bill knows, and let's face it, Arians, he's a bright guy too. He wouldn't be coaching in this league if he wasn't, but there was, I think, more of an understanding now that Tom was there and probably, again, brought a lot of what he learned in New England to there and said, look, we got to keep the ball out of Patrick Mahomes' hands. We got to really dominate the time of possession. The time of possession was more balanced than maybe you would think, but it just felt like, at least in the first part of the game, that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers were going to have a concerted effort to keep the ball out of the hands of Patrick Mahomes. And so they dinked and dunked, and Tom took the outlet pass and was happy just dumping it off to the running backs and move his way down the field. That was a clear kind of conscious thing they did in that game. Very balanced on offense, running and passing, which is a very much a staple of the Patriots. And then on defense, historically, that defense loves to blitz. They love to blitz. But in this game, they rarely blitzed Patrick Mahomes. And they played cover two, which they typically don't do. And we talked about cover two is you play cover two to take receivers out of the game. And you have to, if you're going to play cover two, you have to stop the run. And you know what? Tampa Bay knew that the signal caller for the Kansas City Chiefs, Andy Reid, doesn't have a lot of patience. If you think about it, think about this, Bob. Similarly to what Mike Martz was as the offensive coordinator for the Rams back in 2001, doesn't have a lot of patience, doesn't want to run the football, wants to chuck the ball. Bill Belichick knew that that would be work used against him in that game because all we did was play cover two and defend the pass and not worry about the run. If Mike Martz would have ran the ball more, he could have had to. If Kansas City ran the ball more, they maybe would have had more. They didn't. And so you see a lot of the same kind of ideas, ideologies, and philosophies that Tom brought from New England down there that you would see here. And I found it to be fascinating. A lot of just things that were different than Tampa Bay normally does. And I think that was Tom Brady's influence over the coaching staff and how to game plan and strategize. And that's clearly something he learned when he was here.
You know, maybe in a way, Bill Belichick's influence, too, going back to Super Bowl 25. We talked about this off air with the game plan against the Bills, of course, inviting Buffalo to run it. Yeah. Same thing that I saw in the first game that I called between the Patriots and the Denver Broncos when Peyton Manning, with that high-powered Denver offense, coming into Gillette, handed the ball off to Knowshon Moreno, who ran it through the Patriots defense much of the day before the Pats eventually came back and won that game in overtime. But also key is the cover two, but yet a physical, aggressive defense underneath. They were more physical with the Chiefs at the line of scrimmage than either of the two previous teams, in my opinion, watching the Browns and the Bills. There was a passiveness about the way they played the Chiefs, I thought.
Let me ask you. Okay, so what, in a sense, like, where did he learn that from? Think about how we, our defense in 2004 against the Indianapolis Colts, we beat them up, right? And so when you have fast speed, athleticism, playmaking ability like the Kansas City Chiefs offense has, you neutralize it with physical play, just like we did against the Colts back in the day. Tampa Bay did the same thing, and they just beat those wide receivers up and made it a very physical game and neutralized their speed and their explosiveness. And that's, again, that's, let's face it, that's a Bill Belichick staple right there.
And, of course, they were able to do that in part because they had such a dominant advantage up front with the two interior players, Sue and Villa, and of course, the two guys on the edge, Barrett and JPP.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so that's it. To play Patrick Mahomes, you cannot send a lot of guys. You got to play more coverage, right? So you only really want to send at the most four guys. And Tampa Bay, for the most part, sent four guys. And so they could really play more coverage in the back end. And those four guys really dominated. That was the game right there. It was the Kansas City offensive line versus the Tampa Bay defensive front. And Tampa Bay dominated that matchup right there.
You know, in Ted, well, of course, the Bucs were celebrating. The Chiefs trying to deal with the fallout from Super Bowl 55. And not only the game itself, but perhaps with long-reaching and far-reaching ramifications, what happened just before the Super Bowl. The son of Andy Reid, on the staff as an assistant coach, Britt Reid, someone with a criminal past, served prison time in Pennsylvania, has a history of DUI, brandished a gun in a road rage incident, reportedly. He's someone who joined the chief staff. By all appearances, it seems to be a nepotism hire. He was, of course, at the chief's facility a couple of nights before the team was going to depart for Tampa, rams into two cars at a highway interchange. They're off to the side of the road. There is a young girl, Ariel Miller, 5 years old, hospitalized. She was in a coma earlier this week. Reid was hospitalized too, suspended by the team, and then his contract expired. But I talked to Dan Wetzel, columnist from Yahoo Sports this week, and he raised a really important question in his column, the immediate reaction that he had. Where was the alcohol? Where was the source of the drinking for Britt Reid on that night? Because all logic, rhyme, and reason suggest strongly that he was leaving the facility. Arrowhead Stadium, the Royal Stadium, they're out in the middle of nowhere, basically.
Yes,
there's a hotel across the interstate. And where he was entering the highway off an access road, reportedly, behind the stadium. Somewhat like you guys would exit Gillette in Foxborough.
Group one, yep.
Yeah, so, you know, when you look at that situation, what if there was drinking in the facility that was known to other people? You know, he is an addict, and he could very well have hit it. But what if, as Dan Wetzel pointed out to me, what if he was drinking, watching film with other coaches? You know, how much does the liability, responsibility fall on the organization in a greater sense, and how far-reaching could it be?
Yeah, and that's what's going to be interesting to find out. Is there's an ongoing investigation that it is still an open investigation from what I have read. Another detail in that incident was that he made a phone call before 911. And it was a number that people are speculating that it was either to someone who was, you know, maybe his father or maybe the security, you know, people with the Kansas City Chiefs before he dialed 911. And so that's going to be part of the evidence. But let's not kid yourself. And it was not made a big story, I thought, leading up to the Super Bowl, probably for obvious reasons. But it affected that team. It really affected that team. When you're going into the Super Bowl, Bob, you got to have all distractions at a minimum. And there's an example of something not too dissimilar that happened in the past in the Super Bowl. The Barrett Robbins, remember the center for the Raiders?
Yeah.
You know, went AWOL and left the team and, you know, the night before the Super Bowl, and he couldn't play in the Super Bowl. And it really, I think, affected the Raiders. They did not show up for that Super Bowl. I think to some degree, even though it was very underreported, this story, that this had an impact in that team as far as just their focus and their ability to kind of just lock in on the game. And I think it had a negative impact on their performance in that game.
Yeah, there was a similar situation in a tragic situation with drug use by one of the Bengals years ago before Cincinnati played the Niners. That was, I can't recall the player. It'll come back to me as soon as we go to break, of course, but on the eve of the Super Bowl, who was lost to the Bengals before they played the 49ers when Boomer Esiason was the quarterback. And, you know, one other thought I have as we go to break, how are players around the league going to look at the way the NFL looks into this matter?
Yeah.
Because we know how tough Roger Goodell has been on players when it comes to personal conduct. Well, we've seen a general manager of the Arizona Cardinals get a suspension, and a lot of people felt, I think, rightfully so, that it was really a slap on the wrist when Steve Keim was arrested driving under the influence. There have been other executives for the Broncos.
The Broncos have
been in a similar situation.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So players are going to be watching very closely how the NFL looks into this matter with the Royals, with the Chiefs and Britt Reid.
Big time. Yeah, big time. You know, players are kind of used to maybe seeing front office people get the benefit of the doubt. So I don't know how much of a stink our union's going to make, but it's just, you know, it's just something that's interesting, I think, to follow how it's all handled. But it's unfortunate because Andy Reid is loved in this. Players love playing for Andy Reid. But unfortunately, it looks like in his personal life with his kids, you know, his other son, you know, in 2012, overdosing on drugs at training camp, it was tragic. And now this with his other son, Brett, it's unfortunate. But you're absolutely right, Bob. Guys are going to be watching this. At the end of the day, my feeling is the final analysis, it's going to be really kind of squelched and swept under the rug, and not much will come of it.
Well, nothing is being swept under the rug, it appears, in Houston. There's a lot of dirty laundry that's been aired in Ted's old haunts. And we're going to come back and talk with a guy who knows all of it, John McClain, from the Houston Chronicle, right after this on the Sunday Football Show.
Looking for hope? House of Possibilities offers children and adults with disabilities a path to greater independence. From social to recreational programs to overnight respite and career and community access opportunities, House of Possibilities is changing the way people see disabilities and their program participants see themselves. Visit houseofpossibilities.org to learn more or to support their work. That's houseofpossibilities.org. House of Possibilities. See what belonging can do.
Keeping you updated on all the offseason moves in Foxborough and around the league. It's the Sunday Football Show with Bob Soucy and Ted Johnson on 98.5 The Sports Hub.
All right, welcome back into the maiden voyage of the Sunday Football Show. I am thrilled to bring in our next guest. He's a good friend of mine. He's the reason I'm in radio. He is a legend down there in Houston. He's been covering all things, you know, Houston sports, but mostly the football team. Of course, the Oilers, before it was the Texans. Veteran of the Houston Chronicle for over 40 years. My good buddy, John McClain. Hey, John, how you doing today, pal?
Ted, I'm doing great. How are you and Bob this morning?
We're great, my man. We're great. And so I love that we have a chance to have you on today because so much is going on down there in Houston and with the Texans, and there's a lot of Patriots tie-in. And we'll get to those, John. But, I mean, the biggest news that came out of Houston this week clearly is just J.J. Watt wanting to be released from his contract. The Texans granted him that, and now he is essentially a free agent. This guy is, he's big. I always told people this up here. He's as big to the Texans fans as what Tom Brady is to Patriot fans. And he wanted out after 10 years, three-time defensive MVP. How did it get to this point, John? Take us through what happened there so that J.J. Watt was at a point in which he no longer wanted to play for the Texans.
We've been saying J.J. was gone since the end of the season. It was no surprise. It was just a matter of whether he would be released or traded. He had 1 year, $17.5 million left on his $100 million contract, no dead money. They are, depending on what the cap is, if the cap was $180 million, but I think it'll be more, but say $180 million, then they would be $12.1 million over. So they wiped out their cap deficit and gave Nick Caserios a few million to work with. And he told us at the end of the year he didn't want to be part of a rebuild at this stage of his career. He's got two or three more years left in him. He started every game this season, even though it didn't show up in sack numbers. He had a career low five because he had no help. The defense was awful. The pass rush was terrible and has been since Bill O'Brien traded Jadeveon Clowney to Seattle and took away the only other force up front to help take some pressure off Watt. So he was double teamed all the time, and as he always is, and he wants to play for a contender. He wants to have fun again. Football was not fun for anybody here this year. 4-12 after they were 10-6, beat Buffalo in the playoffs, choked that 24-point lead at Kansas City in the divisional round, and that's where it started to go down the toilet. It was in the second quarter of that Kansas City playoff game, and it hasn't let up. And so 2 weeks ago, Watt went to the McNair family, Janice McNair's home, the controlling owner, and met with her and her family, including Cal McNair, who runs the team, and he asked them to be released. And, he didn't do it through his agent with unnamed sources close to Watt. He handled it the way he thought was best to do it. And truthfully, since J.J. will be 32 in March, and if you had traded for him, you'd have to give him a new contract because you wouldn't want to give him $17.5 million this year. And he did, a lot of the teams that don't have they have a lot of cap money are not Super Bowl contenders. So that's the main thing he wants, is to try to play for a Super Bowl contender. And we make jokes here. I wrote a column today or yesterday about where he could end up, and I think Tennessee, desperate for defense, 19 sacks, and coach he knows very well, Mike Vrabel, and a defensive coordinator he knows from here, Shane Bowen. But the joke is, hey, everybody used to want to go to the Patriots and play for Belichick and Brady for a chance to win the Super Bowl, and now maybe he'll go to Tampa. Tampa's going to lose Shaq Barrett, I think, their top pass rusher, who was franchised this past season and said last week he wanted to break the bank. So why not go over there, buy a yacht, sail around Tampa Bay with Brady?
Sounds good. Sounds good to me.
John, it is good to have you, echoing Ted's words. And knowing what you know and what you said about Watt, maybe more telling about the dysfunction in Houston is what happened this week as well prior to Watt's release. Even an under-the-radar move like firing the equipment staff, which got a reaction from J.J. Watt, among others. The resignation of team president Jamie Rutz. What do they tell us about, not the Patriot way, but the Easterby way? And what's happened to that organization over the course of the last 12 months or so?
Jamie Rutz, who'd been here 20 years, team president since 2005, helped them sell out every game from their first preseason game in 2002 through the 2019 season. And, of course, nobody could sell out this past season. He didn't want to work with Jack Easterby, so he resigned. He didn't say that. He said all the right things, but we've all known it. I've been writing about it for weeks. It was just a matter of when. So he resigned, and Jack Easterby, who is executive VP of football operations, but he has got his fingerprints on just about every part of the organization. Now, Nick Caserio is in charge. Nick has it in his contract. He has final say over everything involving personnel, as Bill O'Brien did. But O'Brien, as the head coach and GM, needed help with all the other departments that come under the general manager's auspices. So he let Easterby handle those, and then when he's making decisions, run them by him, as Caserio will be. They fired their equipment staff 10 days ago, and Caserio hadn't been here long enough to get to know those guys. So obviously that was an Easterby decision. Guy had been here for 10 10 years. It didn't sit well with a lot of people in the organization, and more changes are coming in this organization. I've told people it's not just personnel. By the time they set their 53-man roster the first week of September, I'm guessing Nick Caserio and the new coach, David Culley, will have at least a 50% turnover of the roster. But what I tell people that are all upset about, they think Easterby's making all the decisions, and that's not true on personnel, is give Caserio a chance. There was no, as you guys know, there was no personnel director that deserved to be a general manager more than Nick, no, based on everything he'd done with Belichick. So give the guy a chance. Maybe he does know what he's doing. If you listen to people like Ted Johnson, you think he's got a chance to be a great GM, but it doesn't happen overnight.
Yep. No question. Yeah, no doubt, John. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And obviously, one of the biggest storylines besides J.J. Watt and just the influence of Jack Easterby is the quarterback, Deshaun Watson, being disgruntled and basically saying he wants to be traded. I can't imagine how conflicted the fan base has to be, because I know they love Deshaun there, and they side with Deshaun, I think, of as far as how things are going there. But my feeling is they don't want him to be traded, but he wants to be traded. How do you see that all playing out? Where are the Texans as far as what their feeling is about their franchise quarterback, Deshaun Watson?
In my 45 years covered NFL, I've seen a lot of unhappy players, and it was always because of money, or maybe you were a backup and you weren't getting the playing time you thought you deserved, and you spoke. In the old days, you would speak out in the newspapers, or you would speak out on TV, and then talk shows came. Now everybody does things online. Watson has never said a word. We have no idea, coming from him, what he's upset about. His agent, David Mulligetta, has communicated to the Texans that he wants out and why. Everybody's speculating it's because he doesn't want to play for Jack Easterby. He told us the last time we talked to him, right after the season, he just wants to hold up a Lombardi trophy. Well, Nick Caserio and David Culley would like to meet with him, but he won't get back to them. And if they ever have a face-to-face meeting, which I believe they should, so they can hear from Watson what it is exactly he's unhappy about, and they can explain to him their plan for turning around the franchise. And by the way, Caserio could put his 6 Super Bowl rings on the table, and if he's got Lombardi Trophy replicas, which he probably does, he can put those there and say, here, Deshaun, you want to lift one? Lift one. I know what it takes to win a Super Bowl, and it starts with a great quarterback, and you are our quarterback. Let's do this together. And I think this, that if Watson tells them that he will sit out, lose millions, and maybe he will and maybe he won't, but why would you want to force a player to lose millions and then come back and play for you just for money under bad circumstances when he's miserable? Because I think they need to determine this before April 29th, the start of the draft. And if they believe that he's digging in for the long haul, all season, preseason, training camp, and regular season, I think you have to play 4 games to get credit for the season. Or people say he could come in like James Harden, late, out of shape, play bad, rip the team. Harden just apologized, I think, yesterday about the way he left Houston, because it was ugly.
Yep.
Ugly with Harden, with the fans and the media. But I don't see Watson doing that. That's not his style. He's a great guy. He loves his teammates. Texans treat him like royalty. Mm-hmm. He's under contract to 2025. He's 25, coming off great season in every stat, despite they traded DeAndre Hopkins, Will Fuller suspended for the last 5 games, his slot receiver Randall Cobb missed the last 6 with injuries, and yet whoever they put out there, he made sure they played really, really well. And if they were to trade him, it'd be unprecedented in NFL history. And I've told everybody, if indeed they change their mind, and they have reiterated every time we've asked them, on, off the record, he will not be traded. Mm-hmm. But if you wait till, say, the trading deadline next year, that's a waste. If you wait till the next offseason, you don't know who the quarterbacks are going to be or where you're going to pick. I think they have a chance to compete for the first pick in the draft, and they have their first overall pick again. But to me, I would start with the Jets. They have the 2nd pick, and I would make them give up, like, two ones, two twos, two players, Sam Darnold to play until the number one pick is ready to play, and then trade him for a pick. And that's the only way you could be guaranteed of getting a player you thought, Nick Caserio thought, would be the second best quarterback in the draft to Trevor Lawrence.
John, the staff that David Culley has assembled, what are your impressions of the guys that he's hired around him? And just your impression of him. This is a lifer, well-respected, seemingly beloved around the NFL wherever he's been, moving into that position in Houston and inheriting all the challenges that comes with that job.
Culley is 65 years old. You wouldn't know it when you talk to him because he's just full of boundless energy. He's so happy to have this job. And he never called a play as an assistant coach, neither did Andy Reid, neither did John Harbaugh. And there have been a few others that didn't. And if you're a head coach, I've never thought a head coach should be calling plays anyway. They have too many clock management issues. You know, get coordinators that you think are worthy. They kept Tim Kelly. Deshaun Watson loves Kelly. He told us at the end of the season he wanted Kelly back. He wanted him to re-sign Will Fuller. They're planning to do that. If they don't, they'll franchise him. And then they hired Lovie Smith to be defensive coordinator. Lovie, of course, was defense coordinator St. Louis when they went to the Super Bowl and got just waylaid by some team with Ted Johnson on it. I forgot who it was. And then he was the head coach at Chicago, went to the Super Bowl. And he interviewed here in 2013 or early in 2014 with Bob McNair. McNair loved Lovie. I thought he was going to hire him. And then Bill O'Brien blew him away when he came up there to interview him at his home on Cape Cod. And so they hired O'Brien. So Lovie went to the University of Illinois, got fired, he didn't do well. So a lot of people hear, oh, they don't need Lovie Smith, he bombed out at Illinois. And I said, well, Bill Belichick bombed out at Cleveland. Pete Carroll bombed out at New England and with the Jets. Marv Levy, there's a lot of people who bombed out in the NFL with one team and have done well in another. But I like that hire. They hired Pep Hamilton, who did a tremendous job with Justin Herbert with the Chargers last year. And I'm stunned that the Chargers didn't keep him. So they hired him as quarterback coach. And so I think, I know because I did a story with, like I called Ted, when Caserio was hired, and I did a column with Ted. I called Robert Griffin III in Baltimore, who I've known since he was at Baylor, and he's seen Culley behind the scenes for 2 years, and I interviewed him about Culley, and he played for Pep Hamilton in Cleveland. And I'm not saying he's the be-all, end-all, but when you talk to somebody that's seen people behind the scenes, I trust their opinion when I talk to them on and off the record. And he loved Pep Hamilton, and I know Justin Herbert did. So they have a good offensive staff that knows what it's doing, and they hired an offensive line coach, James Campen, who is at Green Bay, and McCarthy gets fired, goes to Cleveland. That coach, Kitchens, gets fired, goes to the Chargers. Anthony Lynn gets fired. So he's hoping he can last a few years here because he's been with the Packers for 10 years. So they have brought in a lot of new coaches, but the main one that I'm excited about is Lovie Smith. He's going to go from a 3-4 to a 4-3. First time that scheme will be played here since 2010, the year before Wade Phillips came. But he has got his work cut out because the defense is terrible, and they've got to just have an overhaul. And when you don't have picks in the first and second round, but you have eight starting in the third round, that sounds kind of like what the Patriots used to do, is load up after those first two rounds. And so I'm really interested in seeing what Nick Caserio does here with this roster. And I try to tell people, you know, they're going to be worse before they're better. Even if Watson was here this year playing great, and they finished they would have had the third pick, but it belongs to Miami. So if Watson's not here, there's a great chance they're going to get the number one pick in 2022.
Fascinating stuff. The general, John McClain. John, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate that. Give my best to everybody at Sports Radio 610 and to the posse, and we'll catch up with you down the road, buddy. Thank you so much.
Ted and Bob, thank you guys very much. Thank you for having me on, and stay safe.
You too, John. Thank you.
Thank you. John's the best. He's the best. There's so much information. Nobody's more dialed in than he is. And it's a fascinating team to right now because so many things are going on that it's like imploding from the inside. And teams are going to benefit because there's a lot of star players that want to go somewhere else, and they're going to get some good players.
Yeah, and he alluded to the draft and the necessity to make a decision before the draft. They're without a pick in the first couple of rounds because of the Laremy Tunsil trade.
That's right.
So Miami's sitting pretty. Maybe one way to recoup that draft pick that they sent to the Dolphins is to trade Deshaun Watson to Miami. Hopefully from a Patriots point of view, because I think he is one of the transcendent quarterbacks in this league.
You do not want him going to Miami.
No, sir.
You do not want him going
to
Miami. That's right.
All right, we'll continue with more of the Sunday Football Show right after this. The Doug Flutie Jr. Foundation for Autism is proud to be the presenting sponsor of the Boston Marathon's Adaptive Program for Runners, creating opportunities for runners with autism and other disabilities to participate in the legendary Boston Marathon.
Hi, my name is Mike Palmer, and I'm running as a member of the Adaptive Program for Runners in this year's Boston Marathon. Thanks to the Flutie Foundation, runners like me can achieve their dreams and finish the greatest race in the world.
The Flutie Foundation promotes inclusion for all to help everyone achieve their running dreams in Boston and beyond. Visit FlutieFoundation.org to get involved.
Tub. From free agency to the NFL draft, the Sunday Football Show with Bob Soucy and Ted Johnson will keep you covered. 98.5, the Sports Hub.
And we welcome you back to the Sunday Football Show. Bob Soucy with Ted Johnson. We heard from John McClain down in Houston. And, John,
good stuff, right? A lot of information.
Yeah, absolutely. We could have gone on for the rest of the hour at least talking about what's happened. And he brought up the AFC divisional round playoff game between the Texans and the Chiefs. Houston, a 24-point lead, bound for the championship game in the conference. You know, a team that...
Had they just held on,
would have been the favorite to go on to the Super Bowl the following week. And here they are in disarray on the verge of losing, as we just talked about, just touched on before the break, a transcendent quarterback who, in my opinion, outside of Mahomes, is the best among the young QBs that the Patriots have. He's been phenomenal against the Pats when healthy throughout his career.
You know, when I was doing radio down there in Houston for 8 years, it was interesting when Deshaun was drafted by the Texans, and I was doing the afternoon. I was the host of the afternoon drive show there, and we had Dabo Swinney on, his college coach there at Clemson. And I'm not kidding you, Bob. I have never heard a college coach hype up a player more than Dabo Swinney did to about Deshaun Watson to us. And you go, well, that's his coach. That's what they all do. No. Not all coaches are going to go over the top in their praise to talk about their player unless they truly believe it. And Dabo Swinney told us that day when we had him on that he was going to bring multiple championships to that organization, that he was going to transform how the fan base looks at the franchise. And you think, wow, that's put a lot on this kid. But when you look at it, here's a guy in Deshaun Watson who's not disgruntled with his contract. Obviously, they just paid him. He's disgruntled with the structure and the foundation and the culture there, in that it's kind of a rudderless ship, in that it's not going in the direction to where he wants it to go to win games and to win, ultimately win championships. This guy just wants to win. Here's a guy that came in as a rookie. And it was the same year that was, I believe, it was a Hurricane Katrina. I forget what the big hurricane was there. I was there. I should remember the name of it. But it was this horrible hurricane, right? We all remember it. And J.J. Watt.
Harvey.
Excuse me. Hurricane Harvey. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Hurricane Harvey, a few years ago, when that happened, it was his rookie year. He donated his first check in the NFL to two of the ladies that worked in the cafeteria for the Texans. And you talk about, honestly, that was one of the coolest things there. He's just a good kid it's not about that, about branding. He just wants to win.
Yeah, and I think there's a misconception among many that he wanted to have a strong say in who was going to be hired as the general manager. But the organization, reportedly, ownership, led him to believe, if not promise, that he would have at least some input on the decision. And with no communication toward that end, there has been, as John McClain just told us, as a result, down the road, no communication between Watson and the people that are trying to salvage that situation. I really feel for Nick Caserio, because I'm with you. I think Caserio is outstanding in terms of, you know, you talk about versatility as a player personnel guy, college, pro, even the ability to help out the coaching staff in the booth on game days, to be on the field. He's earned the opportunity that he has in Houston, but he's gone into a situation that's almost irreparable.
It almost feels like it is. And so I really feel for Nick, and sometimes I wonder, like, well, gosh, Nick knew he's kind of getting into, like,
no doubt.
But I just think Nick was really looking for opportunities, has been, to go and do his thing somewhere. And so John McClain had me on his podcast, you know, a month ago when they hired Nick. And I don't know Nick that well. But I kind of like him. I get a sense he's a good guy.
He's always been good. He's always been really good in his interactions. You know.
Yeah, everything I hear about him, Bob,
as far as I know, me in particular.
When I was there, he was, I don't know, he was getting Bill Coffey. Like a lot of these guys that are running teams now were, or, you know, 20 years ago. But I made a case for Nick to John and to the fans there in Houston. I said, here's a guy that's seen a lot of how it's been done here, and he has been behind the scenes, and he's been the inner circle and a trusted advisor for Bill. And I said, but he's also kind of seen the last few drafts too, maybe not go the right direction. So I think he's not only benefited from seeing how to do it, but he's also, I think, seen some of the mistakes I think the Patriots have made at the end. Well, he was part of those drafts. We don't know. That's the whole question. We don't know how much involvement and how much influence Nick had when it came to personnel over Bill. We don't know. But we all know that Bill has the final say. So I think he's going to be a better general manager for having, I think, perspective on both sides. Not just all the good, but he's seen things that maybe weren't as good at the end here as far as drafting and that kind of thing.
You know, speaking of the draft and Bill's proteges, I found it interesting when you look at the roster that Jason Light in Tampa Bay had assembled for the Bucs, and not only because of Brady and the acquisitions that they got in this last offseason, but some of the draft choices they have made outside of the first round in particular. And you look at the wide receiver position, Tyler Johnson, very promising rookie receiver.
Was he a fifth rounder?
Yeah, fifth round. And you go back to Chris Godwin, you know, they got him outside the first round. And of course, Jason Light worked for a considerable amount of time as a scout and in player personnel for the Patriots. Now, John Robinson down in Tennessee did draft Corey Davis high. I'm sure that there are mixed feelings about his production in Nashville, but he's, I think, one of the more promising free agents potentially for the Patriots when we're looking at value for the potential production, and as well A.J. Brown. So there have been guys who've been in Foxborough. And I bring those two up in those particular positions because that's been the most glaring position, I think, for the Patriots when it comes to the draft. Not that they have invested a lot of high round capital in that position during Belichick's tenure, but since the Brandon Tate, Julian Edelman draft, you look at the number of receivers, a lot of them, again, taken late in the draft. N'Keal Harry, the most recent, though, taken in the first round, and the Pats just haven't had the kind of success you'd expect.
Yeah, no, they certainly haven't, and I would love, I've always wanted to, you know, sometimes you hear Bill's philosophy on certain positions. We had Phil Perry on in the first hour talking about what Bill covets in a quarterback. I would love to know what Bill Belichick covets in a wide receiver. Like, when he's looking for a wide receiver, this is what I'm looking for. Boom, 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 boom. I would love to know exactly what that is, because sometimes I don't really know what is he looking for specifically. And it's hard for me to predict who he's going to go get at that position, because I don't know exactly what he's, you know, kind of looking at there. So that's interesting. But you get back to the personnel guys that have left here and done well. I think that's going to be something. We're going to be talking about this for the next few months. It's just, let's face it, Bill's had the smallest coaching staff in the NFL and the smallest personnel and scouting department in the NFL. Smallest in the sense of as far as number of people working, you know. And you just wonder, there's a lot of good guys in the front office that have left here to go on, and he's really depleted, I think, some of the talent. And so how does he replenish that? How do you get back? Because let's face it, this is the most important offseason as far as evaluating free agents and evaluating guys in the draft. And you know, you just hope that they got that scouting department and personnel department this offseason in a place that he's comfortable with.
Yeah, and it was imperative to keep Dave Ziegler around. He was potentially going to interview. In fact, he was a candidate for the Broncos GM position. Very important that the Patriots were able to retain him to become the successor to Caserio. And it's not just player personnel. It's the coaches on the field with the players. They've had so much turnover in recent years. And this is an organization that has been known for stability, even when they've lost coaches. But I think there's been so many in a short period of time, it's been hard to replenish that pipeline with guys who've been able to go into those jobs without really learning on the job initially. Yeah. And when you talk about the Pats from that point of view, Ted, I think there's another aspect to this offseason that bears watching. And we're accustomed to seeing this team develop players from year one to year two. Last year, truncated training camp, no spring on the field. I'm inclined to believe that based on what Alan Sills, the medical director for the NFL, said prior to the Super Bowl, what they learned from the tracing and testing this year in the NFL is that they're going to be back on the field for OTAs in minicamp this year. And the reason I believe that is, he said they really learned three things. The virus was transmitted in the NFL facilities through in-person meetings, not wearing masks, and eating. Players eating and exposing themselves and being exposed with other players, with the virus. But it wasn't on the field. They discovered really it wasn't transmitted on the field. So last year there was no time on the field in the spring, right?
That's right.
So to me, I think there's a very strong likelihood that they're going to be on the field this year. That's important for the Patriots because they had a lot of guys. We mentioned Uche at the top. Even if Stidham is going to contend for the quarterback job, it's imperative for them, I think, to be on the field. And Bill talked about, you know, what he learned last year, the difference between, you know, doing things virtually and having that time coaching those guys on the field.
It's crazy. I think, I don't forget the guy's name, but the president of the players union, you know, he's a center, I believe, for the Cleveland Browns. Yeah. Sorry, I can't remember.
J.C. Tretter.
Oh, very good. Way to go, Bob. I heard comments from him not that long ago saying that he thinks everything's worked out great for the NFL this year as far as, you know, players doing, you know, practices via Zoom or doing offseason via Zoom. And I'm thinking that he wants to continue that. That's crazy to me. Like, you need to be on the field getting your reps. And no team, I think, look, every team knows the value of that. But the Patriots in particular, because all the kind of it's a very difficult scheme on both sides of the ball to get to understand and really to comprehend. And with all the new players, they need that time on the field. So I hope that they're allowed to go out there and play and practice on the field and get the reps that way, because otherwise, it's really going to hurt this team specifically.
Ted, before we part ways, one housekeeping note. We were talking a little bit earlier about teams that had to handle situations right before the Super Bowl with players involved, either, as you mentioned, Barrett Robbins going AWOL. Stanley Wilson was the back for the Bengals. I was thinking of somebody else as well. One of our listeners tweeted to me the name of Eugene Robinson.
Yep, Atlanta Falcons. Same thing, man. But, got arrested the night before. Anyways.
Well, let's talk about how the Patriots try to get back.
I got more to say. We're done?
Before we get to the Super Bowl next week.
All right, next week.
Continue to dive into the quarterback position, but a lot more of the Pats trades, free agency, and as well the draft. This was a lot of fun. It went by awfully fast.
It did. I say we do it again next Sunday, starting at 8 o'clock. How's that?
Let's do it again. We're coming up, ready to do it until we take you to the Celtics pregame show with Grandy and Max at 12:30 is Joe Murray. He's in next here at 98.5 The Sports Hub. Thanks so much, everybody.
Looking for hope? House of Possibilities offers children and adults with disabilities a path to greater independence. From social to recreational programs to overnight respite and career and community access opportunities, House of Possibilities is changing the way people see disabilities and their program participants see themselves. Visit houseofpossibilities.org to learn more or to support their work. That's houseofpossibilities.org. House of Possibilities. See what belonging can do. Looking for hope? House of Possibilities offers children and adults with disabilities a path to greater independence. From social to recreational programs to overnight respite and career and community access opportunities, House of Possibilities is changing the way people see disabilities and their program participants see themselves. Visit houseofpossibilities.org to learn more or to support their work. That's houseofpossibilities.org. House of Possibilities. See what belonging can do.